The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 521 for Sunday, September 28th. Happy fall, 2014. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We answer your questions, share your tips, share your cool stuff found. All together, we like to have a lot of fun talking about the Mac and other Apple products like iPhones and iPads and software and hardware and everything. All kinds of fun. Our sponsor for the show today is Squarespace, squarespace.com/MGG. That's where you're going to go to start setting up your website. And then coupon code MGG gets you 10% off. We'll talk about that more in the show. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in balmy Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
Balmy?
Yeah, it's getting in the 70s, man.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
What's going on here, man?
Indian summer. It's fall. It's supposed to happen. That's how it works. I'm actually looking forward to my drive down your way tomorrow. Is the weather supposed to be good for that? Do you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's going to be awesome.
Sweet. That's what I like to hear.
Let me check my weather widget here. Yeah. Yeah. 70s, 60s at night.
Oh, we have a chance of rain up here tomorrow night. Is it supposed to rain down by you or no?
Yeah, it shows cloudy, but...
All right. That's good.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to rain. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, good. We're... A holiday spectacular. Another fine, I think that's Pepcom, right?
I think it is a Pepcom event. Yeah. Yeah. Those are always fun. I always, I enjoy those. It's worth the whatever. Gosh, it's probably turns. I was going to say 10 hours of travel. No, that's probably right. Yeah. 5 hours down, including both ends of it, and then 5 hours back. So, yeah. But it's nice. We get to hang out, and that's good too.
Yeah. Too bad they don't have more of that stuff up in Boston, but
yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 That's fine. It's easy enough. It's no big deal. What are we going to talk about? You know what? Let's just dive right in. There's so many things to talk about. Let's start with Marcus. We'll answer a couple of questions. Then we'll talk about the new iPhones.
Train wreck.
We'll talk about, yes. The what a terrible week it must be to work in Apple QA and or Apple PR. Oh, man. All right. So Marcus writes, I could use some help migrating my Apple ID setup of our family to family sharing. I've been reading family sharing coverage and knowledge base articles, but still have many unanswered questions. For the past couple of years, I've been using following an Apple ID setup that you've been discussing and recommending on the show, Dave. I have one Apple ID for purchases, aka a purchase ID, that is shared between all the family members to be able to access bought apps and media. And then each family member has his or her own Apple ID, basically only for iCloud stuff. I struggle to decide what account I should make the organizer of family sharing. Here are the questions that should help me decide. Does the account that is organizer need to be the primary iCloud account on my devices? Should my purchase ID be the organizer? Should my iCloud ID be the organizer? Okay. If so, should my purchase ID become a member of family sharing as a separate user so that every member can access the previously made purchases? Okay. So I had exactly the same problem you did. And in fact, started heading down this path and stopped because I realized, wait a minute, you know, what am I going to do here? We have basically the same setup as you. And when I went to add my wife to our family share group, I realized, wait a minute, her iCloud ID is different from the ID that, of course, she uses to purchase things in the store. So, because here's the thing. When you set up family sharing, it's touted as this thing that is all about App Store purchases. And it's great. The idea is you set up a family group and then purchases made by any of the people in the group are shared amongst everyone, and all of the purchases are billed to one user's account. And that's great. But there's more to it than that. It does some calendar sharing. It creates a family group for location sharing. It does other things. And all of these things, the family share group in iOS 8 is tied to your iCloud account, your primary iCloud account on the device. So that is, that's the issue, is that it is not, it, previously you'd have an iCloud account and then an account logged into the store. But now with family sharing, it's tied to your primary iCloud account. However, it's not so bad. The pages that you see on the device as you're going through setting this up are not entirely clear. The way it works is you set it up for your primary iCloud ID, and then on the very next page, you get an option of setting which account you want to use for purchases. And that can be a different account. And in fact, if you had a different account listed in the store, it's going to pre-populate the field with that one instead of your iCloud ID. So go ahead and just set it up. You're not going to add your purchase ID as a separate member of the family share group. You're just going to assign that as your purchases ID and leave that as your purchases ID. And it's fine. Everybody in the family share group will still get access to it, and it works great. And it's really that simple. Apple just needs to, and I think they're working on it. They need to just add some language to that first screen to make it clear that, hey, if you've been doing it this way in the past, it's okay. Head down this path and we will walk you through it. You're in good shape. It actually works great. And then once I got past that screen, it was like, oh yeah, 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 no problem. So, the one thing that gets weird is with, gift cards and how payments work. So the way the family share group works is the primary person who created the group assumes billing responsibility for everyone in the group. Now with your kids, people under the age of 18, you can turn on or off an option called authorize before purchase, right? And you can set other people who are over 18 as parents. So my wife and I are both set up as parents. The kids are set up as kids, although we may turn this off for them because it really hasn't been a problem in the past and it's sort of a pain in the neck at times. So, but you know, when the kids want to purchase or even download a free app, Lisa and I on our devices get a little notification. It says, do you want to allow the kid to do this? And you say yes. And then immediately it starts downloading on their device. That works fine. Billing gets a little weird. If no one has gift cards, all the billing goes to the credit card associated with the primary person's account. And it has to be a credit card. It cannot be PayPal. I figured out a way to get PayPal on, but it won't actually bill any purchases to it other than purchases from the primary account. So you got to have a credit card and that's what it gets billed to. That's if no one has gift cards. If one of the kids or one of the sub members, so like my wife or either one of the kids, I'm the primary member on it because I was the one that set it up first. If any of the three of them have a gift card that they've applied to their accounts, their purchases first go against their gift card. And then once the gift card is wiped out, their purchases come against me. If I have a gift card on my account, any purchases I make first go against the gift card, then obviously the credit card once the gift card is wiped out. But if I have a gift card on my account, all the purchases that Lisa and the kids make still go to my credit card. It doesn't go to my gift card, which is kind of stupid. I get why they've separated it out for the sub accounts, but for the master account, what's the freaking difference if my kid charges to my gift card versus my credit card? I just prefer the kids to have, you know, I mean, I've got like $150 worth of iTunes gift cards. I don't want to pay cash for anything. I just want to be charged to my gift card. That was the whole point of it. So that part's a little frustrating at the moment. I'm trying to figure out if I can buy my kids' store credits with my gift card and essentially just chop it up and distribute it around. So we'll see how that works. I may get lucky there, or I may get irate and have to shake my fist in anger. So that's how it works. So it other than the payment thing, which gets a little weird with gift cards, it's really quite straightforward. So that's how that works.
Oh. Oh, yeah, it's good to hear. It's less of a train wreck than it.
Yeah,
in the past.
You know what? Honestly, I kind of, when I saw the whole disconnect at first and didn't realize that it was all taken care of, I did. I posted on Twitter and I'm like, oh man, you know, first thing out of the gate and Apple doesn't get it right. And within about 4 minutes, Chris Espinosa replied to me on Twitter and he's like, what if you do this? And I did it. I'm like, oh, dude, that worked fine. He's like, yeah. Was it not clear you should do that? And I said, no, it wasn't. He's and I told him, I said, some language on this screen would help. He's like, perfect. Thanks for the suggestion. Like, okay, great. Apple employee number 8. Nice. All right. Moving on, shall we?
Sure.
Okay. Let's keep moving here. See how it does. I'm trying to, I'm having caffeine this morning. We had some stream, well, not some stream problems. Boy. We had some issues with the equipment. Well, I thought I had rebooted the studio computer last night and I didn't. So we're a little delayed because I had to reboot it. It was the right decision. Things sound good. And that's how it should be. All right. Let's see. We are moving on to Chuck. Chuck says, I'm new to iPhone, recent convert from Android, and I just got an iPhone 6. I take a lot of pictures for work and really don't want them cluttering up my personal photo stream. I would like to have an app that takes photos into a different stream. Ideally, I would want it to upload, auto upload the photos to my Mac. Is there any app like that? So yes and no. There are some. The first that comes to mind is actually BitTorrent Sync, which has a camera backup functionality and will sync with your Mac or Macs or Windows machines or whatever you want to set it up with. BitTorrent Sync is a serverless cloud, right? So every computer that's connected to BitTorrent Sync is a client and a server simultaneously. And it works. It actually works amazingly well. And your iPhone can participate in this. You install the app. And then on your iPhone, you say, I want to do my share my photos or backup my photos. And it'll give you a code. And you put the code into BitTorrent Sync on your Mac. And now magically, those two are connected. And they're connected whether you're on the same network, whether you're afar. You can tell it don't upload over cellular data, so only when you're on Wi-Fi. But if you happen to be at work on Wi-Fi, it will upload and do your picture backup that way. So BitTorrent Sync, despite the fact that it's in beta and might seem like a, you know, fringe product, man, it's awesome. I've been using it to sync my main document store for several months now and do my photo backup. And it works flawlessly. In fact, I thought I had a problem with it and realized the problem had nothing to do with BitTorrent Sync. It was something else causing issues. So, and once I turned that something else off, it's been great again. So yeah, BitTorrent Sync is probably the simplest answer there. If you don't want to use that, you know, Dropbox does a similar thing, of course, but you're paying for Dropbox storage because there's a server involved. Transporter does a similar thing and does some cool stuff where it'll do auto uploads in the background. If you, and BitTorrent Sync will do this too. If you get to a certain location, it'll do the auto and Dropbox does that now too. So that's, those are my three suggestions, but maybe there's something else, John. What do you got?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, sweet. Well,
there's another one. Bitcasa.
Okay. Tell us about it. Also,
well, Bitcasa is a that's actually a service that I signed up for after who is it? Yeah, after SugarSync started. Telling people, yeah, sorry, you know, we're not doing the cheapskate thing anymore. Go away.
Right.
I'm like, oh man.
Right.
It's like, I want to find another sync service. And Bitkasa, is a fine service and, I'm actually maxed out now on my free space with them, but they also do photo syncing. Actually,
and how much free space do they give you?
Right now I'm at the maximum, which is 20 gigs.
Okay.
Yeah. Similar to some of the other services, you know, yep. Kind of like SugarSync again, until they, you know, and that was the thing that made me sad is, you know, hey, I promoted them in exchange for free space. And then all of a sudden they said, yeah, we're not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
Thanks. But, you know, thanks. But no, thanks.
I agree. That was a little, you know, I can see them taking away the space that that they gave you for free. But there was a quid pro quo there with that promotion that you actually paid, you know, in my eyes with SugarSync, those of us that promoted it and then got space because we promoted it, there was a quid pro quo there.
And Bitkasa does the same thing. I maxed out right now. So okay. I have 20 gigs of space.
Okay.
It works between your, you know, there's a client for pretty much any major platform. And actually just today, you know, I ran the iOS version and it comes up and says, hey, you want to sync your photos?
Oh, sweet.
Which it already did. It, you know, the cool thing also is that whatever folders you sync from your computer,
yeah,
when you're the iOS app, it actually shows a photos category. It's kind of smart. It's like, oh, okay, well, I see that you have photos in your stream here. So you don't have to explain. So it's smart enough to look through the stuff that you're syncing and detect what photos are and let you display them. So I would recommend, you know, as long as you're not going beyond 20 gigs, I think it's worth checking out.
You know, I also, I checked out the Flickr app when looking into this, and there's a setting in there. In fact, I want to.
Oh, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
And so there's a setting inside the Flickr app because you get, you know, a terabyte free or something, right?
Yeah.
And I looked in the settings, and there's a setting for auto sync, and it says auto sync your photos to Flickr. Your pictures are private until you share them. And so I've turned that on. And unless I can't see my pictures, the only stuff that unless I'm missing something, which I don't think I am, I can't see any of my pictures that I haven't manually uploaded to Flickr. So I'm not quite sure what's going on with that there, because that would be a great way to do it. You know, you get full size uploads, which you'd get with any of the other things that you see, you know, that we mentioned here. And in theory, it would do it automatically. But yeah, I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, why that? I don't even know why I didn't suggest Flickr, because Flickr is you know, the primary service that I use to share my photos.
And do yours automatically upload from your iPhone in the Flickr app?
I don't do that. No,
right. Actually, oh, that's right. We talked about that. You use Instagram
Instagram. When I share a photo that I've taken on the phone, Instagram will push it both to Flickr and Twitter, in addition to a couple other services.
And there's
as well.
A big asterisk there, though, because Instagram takes that photo and resize and shrinks it down to 640 by 640. So you aren't getting full size photos if you use Instagram that way.
Yeah, they square the photos.
Well, they don't just square them.
I think down and
they shrink them.
They downsample them a bit. So.
Well, it's more than a bit. It's down to 640 by 640, which is pretty lame when you're taking pictures with an 8-megapixel camera. So, so you know, bear that in mind if your Flickr is not, if you are using Flickr through Instagram, or if you're using anything through Instagram, you're not getting a backup of your good photos. You're getting a backup of your Instagramized photos. And that's just how it works. So yeah, I'm not sure what's up with this Flickr thing and why it doesn't do its auto thing, but you know, that's how it works, I guess. All right. Anything else, or is it time to move on here?
Moving on.
All right. Roland has, he's got an interesting question. He says, I can only imagine the flood of emails you've been receiving since iOS 8's release. I've noticed two things that bug me in the Messages app, and I can't figure out how to remedy them. When I text a photo, there is a header that displays the location, time, and date of the photo to the person I texted it to. How do I stop this? Do I have to stop location services to all photos? That seems a little harsh. And then number two, I can no longer seem to delete individual messages from a conversation. I can still select multiple messages in a conversation, but the trash can doesn't seem to be there. All right. So as far as the location thing, I've tried this, and we've gone back and forth a little bit with Roland. I've tried this, and it seems like it's only sharing my location on pictures with people that I have said I will share my location with in Find My Friends. So but I'm not entirely certain of that. But it seems like there's a wall there that sort of includes several apps and makes a decision for you at that point. Have you messed with that at all, John?
Not really.
All right. Well, that there's more to learn there. In fact, I'd be curious what the rest of you are seeing out there. That would actually be very helpful. As far as deleting individual messages, it's there. It's a little hidden, but it's there. Now, I'm told that it's not there in iOS 8.0, but it is there in iOS 8.0.2. So I'm going to check this and see. But if you go into your messages and then tap and hold on a given message and hit the more button, and I see this in both iOS 8.0 and in 8.0.2, so it's working in both places. Once you choose the more button, you can select individual messages. You get little radio buttons, checkbox type things next to, I guess they're not radio buttons because they're, you can select multiples. But anyway, you can put little check marks next to the images that you want to do something with, or the messages that you want to do something with. And then you've got two buttons at the bottom. One is a share button, which allows you to share that message or messages or those messages with other people. And then the other one's a trash can. And so you can hit that trash can button and then all is good. So that's how that's done. And it at least for me on my iPad in 8.0, which is the only device I have still on 8.0, it works fine. And on the phones in 8.0.2, it works fine there as well.
I just fired this up on my iPhone and it says allow messages to access your location when you use the app.
Right.
No.
Well, no, that's good. You want to do that in iOS 8 because you want to be able to share your location with the people you choose to share it with.
No, I don't.
Okay.
Be mysterious.
Yeah, of course. Another tweak in messages. If you're looking at your messages and you want to see what time a specific message was sent or received, it's not obvious, but if you tap in the middle of kind of the message stream and drag to the left, you will see the timestamps magically drag in from the right side of the screen, which is pretty cool. Does that work for you, John?
Look at this. Oh yeah. No, I've known about that for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that's new in iOS 8, right? Hey, or maybe it is.
It's showing me that you're home. Wow.
I know. Yeah.
What's this text under your contact? Oh man. I'll tell you about that later.
Okay. I don't know what you're seeing, but I'm hoping it's good.
I'll tell you later.
Okay. Good. All right.
Speaking of Dave, you know what's funny? I noticed you missed something.
What did I miss?
I think if I heard you right, you were talking about iOS 8 and then all of a sudden you started talking about iOS 8.0.2. I noticed that you kind of missed talking about 8.0.1. Yeah. Why is that, Dave?
Well, 8.0.1 was available for all of about 40 minutes, I think, on Thursday. Maybe a little longer. Maybe it was an hour and 20 minutes, but it certainly wasn't long.
Actually,
did you really? Oh, good for you.
Oh, and I installed it too.
Okay, now you installed it on a 5S, right?
And iPad Air, which worked great. I didn't see any problems. How about you?
I didn't install it on any of my phones. And I actually at that point in time, I'm trying to think, Thursday was the day that both phones arrived. So the iPhone 6 Plus that I purchased didn't get here until probably 6 p.m. Eastern. So that was well after the iOS 8.0.1 update had been pulled. And then the iPhone 6, which Apple's loaned me for a little while to test out, I think that was here by then, but I didn't do the update, thankfully. You want to talk about this, John?
Well, basically, it was a kind of we're talking about train wrecks here, but yeah. Oh my gosh. So, like everyone else, you know, I was online and, dogpiled like everyone else saying, oh, I got to get the latest software, even though I don't think I really need it. I want to download it and install it anyways. And shortly thereafter, we started getting reports from people saying, hey, you know what? 8.1 has this annoying side effect that it clobbers both your cell service in that after people installed 8.0.1, their phone would all of a sudden say no service up in the menu bar instead of whatever. Normally, you should see the name of your provider up there and some dots.
Sure.
So, but it didn't only clobber that, but it also clobbered Touch ID. And then I was like, oh, man, you know, because while I was reading this, you know, it was in progress.
Right.
On my phone. So I'm like, oh, man, you know, let me kill all data services, you know, turn off Wi-Fi, turn off cellular and see if I can halt this. And I halted it, you know, where it got to the install now phase.
Oh, OK. Yeah, sure. Sure.
And then as I read more and more, people then qualified their statement saying, oh, this only seems to affect the 6 and 6 Plus. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm going to take one for the team and I'm going to install it.
Sure.
And I have the 5S and it installed just fine. So, but, you know, I got to wonder what happened. It was funny because a lot of people did coverage of this. And, you know, I even saw some people, you know, trying to defend Apple, saying, well, you know, it's not due to incompetence or people. And I'm like, you know, it really kind of is, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, somebody missed the boat. I mean, clearly somebody missed the boat.
I'm thinking what happened, you know, and reflecting on this. I mean, you know, things Apple.
It happens.
Apple has, you know, very talented software engineers and,
sure.
And other people like that. I've seen this sort of thing happen in a, you know, enterprise environment before. I'm almost certain what happened is someone made a change at the last minute.
Right.
Saying, let me just do this one thing before you roll it out. And it's like, okay, go ahead. And it's like, yeah. Oops.
Yep. Yep.
And I had that happen before. I actually remember at one point was doing a, you know, a demo for the Big Cheese at a, you know, company I used to work for and was an intern. And I said, do not change anything in the code for this demo because it's to an important person. And, you know, I went away and came back and he made a change. And I'm like, you know what? I'm pulling the demo. Sorry.
Right.
He's like, but no, and I'm like, no. What did I say? I said, don't change anything. It's frozen. And he unfroze it. And it's like, and as it turns out, it was a good call because he did muck something up. So
well, it happens, right? I mean, you know, this is why we go through the process of debugging, and then why in a larger scale, and Apple definitely does this, you go through the process of QA, handing the frozen code to someone else that doesn't know, that can see the forest from the trees, right? You know, because as the programmer on a project, you know the path to take because it's the path you coded, right? Whereas you give this to a QA engineer and that person can now go through in their own way and test it. And I'm sure you're right. Because that I've heard stories of that happening at Apple. Some actually very funny stories about people, you know, trading concert tickets and other, you know, things of value for including cash for the ability to sneak something in because they wanted a feature into the next, you know, OS 10 update and things like that. There are actually some of these are stories of legend. But it happens, and I'm sure you're right. This moved very quickly. To their credit, I agree with you 100% that somebody screwed up, and we need to say that. And I don't, you know, because it's true. I also think Apple did the right thing by pulling the update as quick as they could, and then posting instructions about, hey, mea culpa, we screwed up. If you happen to be affected, here's the steps you take to go back. And then they had the final or the 802 update out within what, about 36 hours or so. Right. I mean, it went pretty quick. Yeah.
And also the, you know, Mac tech community.
Right. We all helped. We all pitched
figured,
in.
Yeah. I mean, I saw various outlets including Mac Observer, but also some others quickly, you know, because people wanted to use their phone again.
Right.
We're like, okay, here's how you fix this problem. You swap out this and do that. But yeah, that was kind of unfortunate.
Let's talk about, because that's not the only potential PR disaster that's happened this week. Although it's the only one that Apple is truly responsible for, solely, I should say, responsible for. there's this shell shock thing, John. Did you hear about this?
Shell shock. Shell shock.
Right?
Isn't that what it's called? I haven't been in combat recently.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, absolutely. I heard about it, and I'm going to wag my finger at some of the coverage.
Okay. Go.
Similar to Heartbleed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is shell shock? So someone found in the bash shell. So what is that, you may ask? And if you go to the terminal, there are various programs that will process your input on your behalf. And one of them is called bash. And from what I've seen, that is actually the default.
It is. Handler, that's right.
Yep. Under OS 10.
Yep.
And all of a sudden somebody found a bug where if you fiddle with the environment variables and you type things in a certain way, an attacker could compromise your system.
That's right.
The thing where I have to finger wag is similar to Heartbleed, is that it's not like the hackers of the world are all of a sudden going to dogpile on your machine and take it over. It's not, it doesn't,
right?
Yes, it is a potential attack vector. Someone could take advantage of your system. But what I saw with a lot of the coverage is that there's a caveat in that you have to have a system that's running certain things in order for you to even be susceptible, right?
Probably.
So here's, as far as most people know, and even Apple addressed this too, that they said, you know what, for the most part, unless you're running some advanced Unix services, probably don't have to worry about this.
Which was the stupidest thing Apple PR has done all week. Yeah,
really?
Saying the words advanced Unix services and not qualifying that is so irresponsible. Okay, I mean, that really, as you can tell, that got me fired up. Also, the caffeine.
run with it, man.
Yeah. No. So the way shell shock works, and this bug, as far as we know, has at least been in Bash for a decade, and probably for three decades, with no known widespread exploits. Now, I'm careful to say that I am certain people have exploited this, and I'm pretty sure Newt Sears was exploiting this about 20 years ago when in an unrelated story, I had an account on the Reed Vax. But anyway, I think this bug has been known about in very small circles for a while. But obviously didn't come to light until recently. But no one has created, even now, to my knowledge, no one has created a widespread exploit for it. The way it works is as John said, the bash shell is the thing that you are interacting with when you're in the terminal, at least by default. If you've changed it, then you already know that. But or if you've upgraded and never done, if you've only done migration assistance since like 10.2, you might be still running T shell. But by and large, you're going to be running bash on your Mac. And the way this bug works is bash allows you to set in memory variables, environment variables, and that's what they're called, but they live in memory. They're resident variables, and they are things typically used for things like here's the path to the application I want to use as my editor, or here's my time zone, or things like that just need to live in memory, and you can call upon them in your scripts and other ways and get them. The problem is, as it turns out, and this is what shell shock is all about, is you can stuff commands inside of those environment variables and then they run. Now, this doesn't seem like a very big deal. Yes, it shouldn't happen. But if you're already at the terminal, the fact that you can stuff a command into an environment variable and get it to run is really not that big of a deal because you're already at the terminal. You could just type the stupid command, right? So it's not that big of a deal. If you've got shell access on a computer, you're already good, right? Shell shock isn't going to help you at all if you're a nefarious attacker. Where this becomes a problem is if you are running a service or a script that relies on bash to do some of its work. Now, we as programmers, especially web programmers, know that relying on the shell to do work for a web environment is very, very risky and irresponsible. And so therefore, we do it all the time. right? It we know these two things, but it's super simple because we live in the shell all the time. When it comes time to solve a quick problem, you know how to do it in the shell. So you say, oh, great, I'll let my web server attach to the shell by means of a CGI script, and I'll use that script to do some work and then return the result or do whatever it needs to do back up through CGI common gateway interface to the web. Now, most of the time, the person on the web has no idea what engine is processing their request. You might be able to tell by URLs, but sometimes not even that, right? And that's where the problem comes in, because if it, and this, I'm going to get very specific here. My guess is that there are no widely used scripts that would be susceptible to this, although there may be. My guess is that all the scripts that are susceptible to this are like the ones I just described. You had a quick problem that was unique to you. An existing solution was not out there. So you wrote a shell script, you put it in place, and boom, problem solved. Move on to the next dilemma. So if someone knows how your script works and knows what the names of your variables are, and how those variables get populated, it's possible that they could put some information, inject some information, like instead of putting it, if somehow in your script, you're taking what a user enters as their first name and stuffing that into an environment variable. Now, why you would do that? Well, you might, right? It might be the simplest way to solve the problem, even though it's not the best. And so if the user knows that, they could put a big long string in as their first name that executes a command, creates them an account on your computer, sets the password to something they know, and then would allow them to log in. And this is what Shellshock could do. But you just heard me explain this. The person on both, the person attacking needs to know a lot about this script that's running, right? And this is why we haven't seen. Is it good that this bug is getting patched? Absolutely. You know, but this is not a huge, like, you know, run screaming in the streets kind of problem. But again, it's good that it's being patched. Now, I was, you know, when I first heard about it, Jeff said, can you come on Timo Daily Observations and talk about it? I said, well, let me research it first, because I didn't want to go on and make stuff up. And I went on and started reading it. And at first I was like, whoa, holy crap. We got to patch our web server right away. And there's a little test. If you go to shellshocker.net, there's a little test you can do. In fact, there's two tests you can do. Oh, turns out there's five tests you can do. This is a developing thing, right? So, and there's multiple patches. At first, there was just one patch that you would have to do. And then there was somebody realized, oh, no, that patch doesn't fix this particular use case. And now, as it turns out, there are five different patches at shellshocker.net. And thankfully, we run CentOS on our thing, and our hosts keep us up to date on this stuff. So so they were actually in the process of patching all the servers anyway, and in fact have done ours. And so we're in good shape. They use, because we run CentOS, we use a package manager there. And so the simple thing is, I think the command, if I'm remembering, is just yum, which is the name of the package manager, update bash. And then that's it. It updates bash and you're good to go. OS X has a package manager, but it does not yet have the new version of bash in it. And OS X's package manager is what we call software update. Okay. So we cannot install an updated version of bash that way yet, because Apple hasn't released one into their repository, right, of software update. But you could compile your own version of bash, or you could make your life really, really simple and use Brew, Homebrew, which is an additional package manager for OS X. And installing Homebrew on your Mac literally takes one step from the one command on the command line. And then from there, you just go to the command line and you would install bash. And then you have to do one little thing to move Apple's bash out of the way and put Brew's bash in where that would be. And then you're good to go. But again, unless you're running a publicly accessible web server or some other publicly accessible service, an FTP server may be exploitable too. Especially if it's running a certain type of FTP server.
Right.
But you know, these things are possible. So if you're running public services on your Mac, then yeah, go ahead. And you know, where you need to pay attention is on like things like our disk stations, right? Because those are running, right? Those are running Linux. Yep.
A lot of routers are running embedded Linux.
Yes.
So somebody could hijack your, I don't believe Apple's.
A lot of routers are running embedded Linux, but not running Bash. I noticed my router because that was something I was really worried about. And I looked and the bug doesn't exist because my router runs a very slimmed down version of the shell because it doesn't have a lot of RAM. Right. It does have a lot of RAM, but they didn't used to. And so they've you know, packed these things down and said, OK, we only need, you know, a subset of the commands because it's just a router. So, you know, we don't need full Bash. And so a lot of these things aren't a problem on routers. So yeah, check out shellshocker.net. Not only do they have the tests there, but they have instructions on how to update OS 10, all flavors of Unix, but OS 10 is there, and they do walk you through very, very quickly how to do it with Brew. So we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah. So but that's a good caveat. If you're running a server, then it's something you should be concerned about, I would say.
Yeah.
And I'm with you, the whole, and it was even, who was it? CERT, I think, which is, you know, the United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team and others. I'm not happy with the way they reported it because they all said, oh my gosh, it's a 10 out of 10 as far as, you know, a threat and it's easily exploitable. And I'm like, guys, same with Heartbleed. They started getting people in a panic, and Heartbleed, while it's also a threat, was a threat.
Yep.
Was something that, you know, your basic script kiddie isn't going to be just throw together. And it was a pretty sophisticated, you had to do a lot of things in the background in order to, you know, take advantage of this exploit.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It's crazy.
So, and speaking of getting people in a panic and bad PR, Dave.
Yeah, yes.
The final one here. We'll move on to some more questions, I think. But this one just got me. So I'm going to call it because I think this name totally embraces the nature of the problem is Benghazi.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
For those unfamiliar, there was a attack against our embassy in Benghazi, right. Libya. And a lot of, I don't know, in my personal opinion, a lot of people felt there were things happening that really weren't, that it was an overblown non-scandal. Now, some people may still believe that it is a big scandal, though I think most people have concluded that it's not.
You know that I emotionally support all conspiracy theories, right? Even if I don't intellectually support them, I like them.
Yeah. All I'm going to say is that they had, you know, hearings upon hearings upon hearings, and for the most part, everybody's come to the conclusion that there was not, in fact, any sort of scandal. Though there are some that will believe that, yes, there was.
Moving along.
So, and you know, that this one got me angry, too. So all of a sudden, it hit the media here that, oh, gosh, there's a quality issue with the iPhone 6. It's like, really? What is it? And you can confirm
6 Plus.
I have one, Dave.
Well,
the 6 Plus.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And the controversy, and I even saw a video, but this one made me angry. they were like, oh my gosh, the phone bends. It's like, oh, yeah, okay. Consumer device made out of aluminum bends?
Yeah, a thin, long consumer device made out of aluminum bends. Yes.
What got me is the one video that I saw, and I wish I could reach through the screen and punch the guy, but it was a video of a guy bending the phone, and he said, right. Oh, and I'm doing this for science.
Right.
And it's like, dude, if you're not going to tell me the amount of force that is required to bend this, you are not a scientist and you are not doing this for science. You're just trying to get page views.
Yeah, that's right. What's the issue?
As it turns out, I think, I don't know if you've tried to bend your phone, but it turns out a substantial amount of force is required in order to bend the iPhone 6 Plus.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Consumer Reports did some testing, and they found that, as it turns out, the iPhone 6 Plus is stronger than the standard iPhone 6. It took 90 pounds of pressure to bend the 6 Plus, and only 70 pounds to bend the six. But there were, and I'm looking here, the Galaxy Note 3 was the winner in terms of the fact that it takes 150 pounds of pressure to bend that one. And Consumer Reports also said that one of Apple's tests, and I don't know where they get their information, uses only 55 pounds of pressure to test their devices, which now why they've chosen 55, there may well be a reason, or there may not be, right? But here's the deal. So I've had an iPhone 6 Plus since Thursday and a 6. I've decided to use one of them, and I want to talk about this, but I've decided to use the 6 Plus first, and I'm going to give it a couple of days week to test and get used to it, and then switch to the 6 and do the same thing a couple of days week, and then decide which one is right for me, and I'll keep you posted. In fact, I want to talk about my findings, but I want to talk about our first sponsor first. However, what I will say before we do that is that I have had the 6 Plus in my pocket in jeans, so the tightest pockets I would wear. I've had it in walking. It's fine. I've had it driving in my car where I'm sitting and, you know, kind of cramped in. It's fine. I had it sitting at a restaurant. It's fine. I've had it sitting at my drums. It's fine. I've had no issues. This is my front pocket that I've had this device in. So it has not bent, nor has it been uncomfortable. But I am also 6'3", so my legs and therefore my pockets may be deeper than yours. I don't know. But there you go. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it with that. Can we talk about our first sponsor here, John?
I insist.
All right, great. So this is our first sponsor for the show is Squarespace, squarespace.com/MGG. These folks have taken the idea of setting up, designing, and hosting a website and packed it all into one. You don't have to worry about shell shock. They worry about that, right? You don't have to worry about coding HTML if you don't want to. They worry about that. What you worry about is designing your website visually right there inside the web browser that you would use to view the site. And it really is that simple. I mean, we've had, you know, WYSIWYG editing in many capacities for years, but doing it inside your web browser on the web makes a lot of sense because that is the environment in which you're going to be seeing it. So any of those weird interpretive things that might happen, you know, if you were to happen to code this manually on your computer and then you look on the web and you're like, oh, it's different. That stuff doesn't happen with Squarespace because it's all right there in your web browser. And it's super easy. You visit squarespace.com/MGG. You don't type in your name. You don't give them a credit card, nothing. The first thing you do is pick a template that you want to use. And they have these gorgeous templates that they have designed. They work for months on each one of these templates. They make sure they work in all browsers, and they also make them responsive. And what that means is the template itself changes depending on the size of the device viewing it. So when somebody visits you from their Mac, it looks good. When somebody visits you from their iPhone, it is an iPhone design, but there's no different URL. It doesn't send people to, you know, m.davethenerd.com. It just www.davethenerd.com. That's my blog. That's at Squarespace. And it resizes automatically because the templates that they've built are perfectly designed for all of and tested, as we talked about earlier in the show, for all of these devices before they're rolled out. And what's cool is because these templates are all built by Squarespace, you can customize them. As I said, you can put your own pictures and you can relay them out even. If you know HTML or even get like a snippet of code from somewhere that you want to inject into your page, you can do that too. That's totally flexible. Drag your own pictures in and it's cool. You drag them in from the desktop and they just magically appear in the page and then you can resize them and tweak them and all that stuff. But if maybe you have a template, you set it up, you like it for maybe a month, maybe a year, and then you decide it's time for a change. Well, what's cool is you go into Squarespace, you say, I want to change my template. All of your content is magically inside this new template, reformatted to fit that template. They make sure that fields and locations for all of your content for the type of site that you're publishing have room in the right templates for that type of site. It's really cool. Highly recommend you check it out. And they've also got integration with payment processing, and they use Stripe. So you don't need to get a merchant account. All you need to do is have a place where they can send your money. And you can get completely set up with you going from all you have is a bank account where they could deposit money and nothing else. And within an hour, you could be up online with a website with payment processing attached to it and receiving money, good to go. It really is streamlined and these folks know what they're doing. And here's the thing. You can get 10% off of your first purchase with coupon code MGG. So go sign up. You know, you get 14 days free once you sign, once you create your template and all that stuff. And then once you're ready to go live, you put in coupon code MGG. I recommend signing up for a year because you're not going to change web hosts, you know, more often than that. So sign up for a year. You get it for $8 a month plus your 10% off, or minus your 10% off, I should say. And you're good to go. And then once you've set up your site, do us a favor, tweet us at MacGeekGab is us on Twitter, and tweet us with your website address and the hashtag Squarespace shout out. And we'll go ahead and promote your site to everybody that follows us there on Twitter. So check it out. Squarespace.com/MGG. They're good folks and appreciate their sponsorship. And I appreciate all the sites you folks create. It's quite amazing. All right. So, John, these two iPhones, right?
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I have them both. I've got them set up, but and I've of course used them both. But for right now, I'm focusing on the 6 Plus, and it's big, right? There's no question about it. But it's super handy having a device like this everywhere I go. The other night, I had stopped to get gas, and I got a text from, I had just left the office. I was on my way somewhere, and I got a text from John Donahue at Backbeat saying, "Hey, we shouldn't have started this campaign, or we need to stop this campaign because the sponsor wants to change their banner creative." And I thought, okay, well, stop it here. And then when I get back to the office later, I'll go in and do the other thing that needs to be done. Just, it was a kind of a weird setup with this campaign. And then I thought, I got back in the car and I'm like, wait a minute. I don't need to wait till I get home. I've got this huge screen with me here. And sure enough, it was totally cake to go into the web interface and tweak everything out. And it, you know, it didn't feel cramped. It was just great. And then I texted him. I said, actually took care of it. All good. And I've had a couple of instances like that where I've had more than a couple. I've had a lot of instances where having this big screen with me really makes a difference. And other than this theater show that I'm doing where I need to use an app that is iPad only. I have not used my iPad, my Retina iPad mini since I got the 6 Plus. And that's a conscious decision. I want to see how it is running things on this. And reading is fine. Email is great. Having this larger device really makes a difference. My only complaint, and I wrote an article about this the other day, my only complaint is applications, right? Because Apple has designed this device and they've designed their own apps to work with it. But third-party apps, this device truly sit, you know, I know a lot of people hate the word phablet, but it's the right name for the 6 Plus because it sits in between the sizes of a phone and a tablet, right? And it sort of does both. It runs iPhone apps. It does not run iPad apps because iPad apps are 4:3 aspect ratio and phone apps are much closer to 16:9 or perhaps exactly 16:9. But when you run an iPhone 5 app on this thing that has not yet been updated either with auto layout or with specific design choices for the 6 Plus or 6, and this happens on the 6 too, albeit to a lesser degree, the system zooms the entire app in, not just the app, but the clock at the top gets zoomed in and the keyboard at the bottom gets zoomed in. So that gets a little frustrating because, you know, in some apps, the keyboard is smaller and some apps it's bigger. And it makes these iPhone 5 apps feel kind of like a clown show. Now, I don't blame developers for this. They've known about the size of the 6 and 6 Plus for less than 2 weeks, right? But it's up to them to make this experience work or not work, because the apps that have been updated show a lot of promise. You know, a year from now, will this platform be fantastic? Probably. You know, is it fantastic right now? Sometimes. And other times it feels like a clown show. But it, you know, there's enough of it that works. You know, I posted an article and talked about this and showed the Facebook app, which hasn't been updated. And then, of course, Facebook on the web, which is in Safari, which is Apple's app. So therefore has been updated. And it's a much better experience through Safari right now, because everything isn't, you know, overblown and all of that. But as I mentioned, it fits in my pocket just fine. It has yet to bend. I don't expect it to bend. I don't have a case on it, but I'm going to remedy that before I come down to see you tomorrow, John, because I don't want to go into Manhattan without a case on this thing. If in fact my experiment with the iPhone 6 leads me to decide to go with that instead, I want to make sure this thing is in pristine condition when I return it. So, but it's, you know, it's a great device. There's some UI stuff I need to get used to. They did that whole thing with the reachability mode, where when you tap the bottom, when you tap the Touch ID sensor, it brings the top of the screen down so that you can touch it easily with your thumb, and that's fine. Except the device is not balanced to be held at the bottom; it's balanced to be held in the middle, which means that reaching the top or the bottom of the screen is sort of the same kind of stretch. So I'm not exactly sure how that's supposed to work yet. But I have been successful, you know, texting with one hand, you know, that kind of thing. What I would love to have is a keyboard that shifts everything to the left. Basically take the size that a keyboard would be on an iPhone 5 and then just put it left aligned so that I can type with my left thumb and I don't have to reach all the way over to the right, or a right aligned keyboard for people that want to type with their right thumb. Right. That would be a cool thing. And probably very easy to do, and probably something that would sell like hotcakes for 99 cents. But it's good. Do you have any questions, John?
No, I'll wait to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like what they have to do, and I've dabbled with Android devices, and I don't know if Apple is at this point yet, but it sounds like what they need to do, last I looked at Android, I think they actually have four classifications for screen sizes when you write your apps.
Right.
Where you say, okay, if it's small, do this. If it's medium, do this. If it's large, do this. And I guess they're not yet at that point. And it sounds like that's what you're suggesting should happen at some point.
It should. Yeah, exactly.
It's because it's a unique form factor that they should, developers should eventually tailor their applications to say, oh, I'm running on 6 Plus, so I should look like this.
Yeah. You know, at WWDC, Apple was doing their best to telegraph this thing coming by in every session. The mantra was stop designing for fixed sizes and use auto layout and give rules and parameters to how an app should behave on any given screen size and pixel depth. And if you did that, then, you know, things like we're in the Mail app on the 6 Plus, and this doesn't happen on the 6, but in the 6 Plus, if you're in the Mail app and you turn it and go landscape mode, it feels more like an iPad at that point. You get a list of your messages on the left, and then the text of your message, or the content, I should say, of your message on the right. And if you go back into portrait mode, then it's back to kind of what I would call normal iOS Mail mode, where, you know, you just have a list and you tap a message and then it moves you to that message. So, and that's where auto layout really comes in to play. So we'll see, but it's interesting. And I, like I said, I've been happy with the device. I'm curious to see how I like it in my pocket with a case on it. One thing that I will mention about the iPhone 6 is Apple sent it to me with one of their cases, the silicone case. This case is awesome. It's one of my, it's thin, but it clearly feels protective. It's not difficult to get on or off the device, but it doesn't just fall off the device. It feels good sliding in and out of my pocket. It's awesome. So if you're looking for a case for your six or perhaps for the six plus, I mean, I'm assuming it's going to feel the same on that, then that's a way to go. Check that out. They have the silicone and then for a couple bucks more, the leather. I really like the feel of the silicone one. So that's worth checking out. So any other questions or thoughts on that? Or we'll let it iterate as we move on. If you folks have any questions, of course, please ask and we'll queue them up. All right. Where are we here? We've been all over the place with this show, John. We're at the 1 hour and 10 second mark for those counting at home.
Oh, I got 24, 25 seconds. Okay.
Well, you started recording earlier than me.
Right. So, questions. Let's go to a question.
Yeah.
Thad has a question. And the question is as follows. Is there an easy way to give my wife read-only access to my home folder and everything in it? She has an account on my computer. I don't want to share my password with her just in case things go foobar. Without my password, I will know she is not to blame.
Well, that's actually really smart, right? You know, it limits the opportunity for blame. But also that's good. Yeah. I get it.
I mean, I'm seeing a trust issue here, which yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, we're not marriage counselors, so.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't read it that way at all.
I did.
Okay. Yeah. No, I read it that he doesn't want to have,
Oh no, I get it.
Yeah. But anyway, move on. Yeah.
Well, to me, one way to address this, would be as follows, is highlight your home folder. Because what's going to happen normally is that from what I've seen, so if she logs in right now, what should happen is if she goes to the hard drive and then I guess users and then, you know, to his account, it's going to show, you know, a little circle with a line through it saying, go away, you can't get to this. That's the default behavior, last I checked, of OS X. For different accounts, is normally different accounts, different user accounts cannot see one another. Admin can, I think, or even admin. No. Anyways, here's one thing you could do. So highlight your home folder, right click on it, or do a get info. And what you're going to see on the bottom is a little section. You may have to click on the triangle to expose it, called sharing and permissions. Sounds like exactly what we want to do, Dave.
Yep.
I think. And then you'll see a little plus sign. And what it should show, the default will be something along the lines of, you know, access for you is read and write. Okay. And then access for everybody else is probably no access. So one thing you can do is you can add what I'll call a rule here or a permission, if you will. And you, there's a little plus sign. So what you do is you click on the little plus sign in the lower left-hand corner. And then you're going to get a list of the users. And so what you want to do is select your wife's account, and then you click on the select button, and then you're going to see, and I believe, let me look here, I believe it actually defaults to read only. Yeah, so I just created a new rule here, and the privilege will be read only. I think that's exactly what you want to do. Right?
Yeah, I think that would work.
So to directly answer his question, if you see the answer as how do I grant permission to do this, that's the way to do it. But you go.
No, you're totally right.
Thoughts about how to accomplish this.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. If we're answering the question specifically, this is the answer, right? It's the way to do it. My concern with solving this problem this way, and by problem, let's abstract it out of, I want to give my wife read-only access to my documents, as opposed to I want to give my wife read-only access to my home folder. The issue is there are things, maintenance scripts that you may run, where you're resetting the home folder permissions and then breaking this potential change. Again, resetting the home folder permissions is not something that happens automatically. It's not what happens when you go into Disk Utility and choose repair permissions. That resets everything else, systems permissions, apps, and things like that, but not your home folders. But if you do run the home folder reset, that's going to blow this away and get you back to ground zero, which is at times what you want. I feel like a better way would be to use the shared folder. So if you look in your home folder and then go up one level to see all the users, or you go to the hard drive and go into the users folder, you'll see your user, presumably your wife's got an account, so you'll see hers. And then you'll see a shared folder there. And this would be a better place to put things that you want to be shared. And then you still can set read permissions and ownership and all of that on things that you've put into this shared folder. And it when you do all those repairs and things, this is excluded from that. So it's sort of built for that. Again, though, this may not be what you want because you, you know, when you back up your home folder, this does not get included, right? You know, when you back up your documents folder, this does not get included because it's not in your home folder. It's not in your documents folder. So you need to decide which way you want to solve this problem. There's nothing wrong inherently with doing it either way. But as we've explained, both of them kind of come with caveats. So that's there you go. That's my thoughts on it. You know, I mean, my final thought on it is that if you had something like a NAS device, right, where you stored your documents there, then you have some permission things that you can set and not worry about OS X changing them because it's not on your OS X device. But that abstracts it out even more and probably is not the right path to head down, but worth mentioning. So, right? Any other thoughts on that, John, or did we cover it?
No, okay. We're good.
Yeah. Felix had a question that probably is going to help a lot of people, I think, John. I hope.
Or confuse them.
Yeah, well, right. It's a good question, though.
Yeah, and so I dove right into this here, and basically, Felix's question. So he had a problem that he solved himself, which was great.
Yeah.
But then he asked the question, basically saying, hey, guys, how do I read these crash reports? What do they mean? What's a crash report?
What are they driving at?
So what is a crash report? So many of you, unfortunately, probably have seen these in the past. And usually they present themselves in that your application will crash and that it will stop running. And then you're going to get a dialogue that shows you a whole bunch of what is pretty much developer gibberish or geared towards developers. And it saves this on your computer as well. How do you interpret what's in there? Boy, you know, it'd be great if there was an article that explained how to interpret what's in there, Dave. Guess what? There is an article.
Seriously?
And we'll link to it. Yeah. Well, I figured, you know, hey, gee, maybe there's something, maybe at Apple, that explains how to do this. And in fact, there is. And I think it's TechNote 2123. And it goes into excruciating detail about what each portion of the crash report means. But that can get a bit overwhelming because there's a lot of stuff in there that for most people means nothing and is not helpful. To help you identify why something crashed. For developers, it certainly is. First off, where do you find these things? Because you'll see a dialogue. It'll be displayed on your screen, and then you can say, yeah, and it'll ask you to put in some commentary. And typically what happens is eventually if you make a certain choice in the operating system, it'll send those off to Apple so they can figure out what's going on. But I would say the main thing, Dave, is where you want to look if you want to try to diagnose a problem of software crashing repeatedly is you look in these. So first off, they're probably going to be in a library folder, your library folder. And then you dig in. So you go to library, logs. And then last I looked here, at least on one of my systems here, there's going to be a directory called diagnostic reports. There's also another directory or folder called crash reports, but looking at least on my system in front of me here, most of them are in diagnostic reports. And then you'll see a file that ends in a .crash. You may see other things like .spin or .shutdown spin, things like that. But dot crash is the crash report. And if you double click on it, it should open it up in the
console app.
Console.
Yeah.
Here's what you want to look for, I think, if you want to diagnose a problem. So ignore most of the gibberish here, because again, it doesn't mean anything to you. But what you're going to see at some point towards the top is it's going to say crashed thread. That's the important thing. What is a thread? A thread is it's basically a program running alongside a whole bunch of others, or a process.
It's a piece of a program, right?
Right. You can have multiple threads. Programs can tell the computer to do multiple things kind of in parallel.
Yeah, it's a task, right? That's yeah, active. It's a task. But like John said, yeah, you can have many things running. And what this is telling you is which of those tasks triggered this particular crash. And that's super helpful.
Right. Because then what you're going to see after that is you're going to see a list of all the threads that were running at that point in time, or that the that program was launching. So you want to ignore all except the one that it said crashed.
Yeah.
So like I'm looking at one here right now. I'm not going to mention the the program that did it. And it says crash thread 12. So you look on the list, and now I see thread 0, thread 1, thread 2. Okay, let's fast forward to thread 12.
Sure.
And so I'm looking at thread 12, and then what you're going to see is things going in order. Then you're going to see the name of a process. Or thread, and then after it, you're going to see a hex number, and then you're at some point what you may see is the name of whatever module or program caused the grief, or you may not. One example that I saw is that at one point I had iTunes crashing on me.
Okay.
And I was like, wow, why is it crashing on me? What's going on here? And eventually I looked in the crash report and I looked at the crash thread and I saw the word QT something or other. Oh, QuickTime. What actually happened is that there was a ancient QuickTime plugin causing a crash. So that's how you read these. So look at the tech note. To me, that's the quickest explanation. I don't know if you have anything to add there, Dave. But
no, that's a good start. I mean, the problem is it's impossible to go through and talk about every permutation of what you're going to see inside these. But and sometimes you'll follow the instructions that John gave exactly, which is exactly the same thing I do, and probably the same thing all of us do. And you'll get to that thread and you'll look through it and you'll be like, yep, I have no idea. Yeah. And that happens a lot, right? But sometimes, like John said, if you look and just think about what's happening there, it might actually help you diagnose a problem. It's certainly not a bad thing to do, but don't expect the crash reports to be a magic fix. We've had a lot of times you folks will, if you have an app that's crashing or whatever, you'll email us the crash report. And we do the same thing. This is the process we take and go through them. And sometimes it highlights the answer and sometimes it doesn't answer it at all. And we've gotten some frustration. Like, well, I sent you the crash report. Like, yeah, I know, but it doesn't contain enough, at least not for us. Now, maybe the developer would be able to look at it and say, right, I know what I'm doing there.
Well, that's it, because it's often referencing the name of something that the developer has defined.
Right.
And if they use nice descriptive names for what they're doing, then then you'll figure it out. But if they use crazy names for their variables or their function names, then you won't figure it out.
You won't figure it out. Right. Or if you don't understand what their function would have been doing, I mean, sometimes you'll see descriptive names. You'd be like, yeah, still, what does this have to do with my app? Right. Or what I'm doing. But it's not a bad place to start, but don't get too bogged down by it. If it's not immediately obvious to you what it is, move on and test something else. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's kind of sad. And I was actually chit-chatting with our buddy, Alf Watt the other day about this. Unfortunately, these reports are sent to Apple or automatically sent to Apple. They are not sent to the developer of the software that has crashed.
Not on the Mac.
Right. Currently, now, if Apple gets enough of them with a certain program, then they may, you know, call them, I suppose. But the thing is, there is no mechanism in OS X to send, within the operating system, to send these crash reports to the developer. Now, right. He's actually working on a, and we'll link to this, he's actually working on an open source thing to do this, which is great.
That's great. That's a good thing.
Now, the other thing is, if you get these crash reports, you may want to make a copy of them if you want to help the developer, if the developer wants it, and you can identify who they are. You may want to save it, because like I mentioned, eventually the OS will send these off to Apple and delete them. Right?
Right. Right. That's okay. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, man. That's all right. I got to say.
No, it's good. That's good. All right. Let's see, what else can we do here? You know, let's go. We're running short on time. We're running toward the end of our time together, but we've got a couple of tips that have come in that are good stuff. Simon says, he was having some issues with iTunes and getting it to, sync properly with his phone. He says, here's what he did. He says, on the phone, I'd taken a screenshot of the music app so I could easily refer to artist, album, and track. He was trying to get things where playlists would sync with the phone, and they weren't. The first thing I did was to confirm that the affected tracks on the iPhone would play okay in iTunes on the computer. No problems at all. Deleted the entire music library off the phone by going into Settings, General, Usage, Storage, Manage Storage. So deleting it from there. Strangely, this took me several attempts, writes Simon, combined with turning the phone on and off and resetting. Eventually, the music storage amount had dropped to near zero. I then connected my phone to my Mac and loaded iTunes, but didn't sync. At this point, I turned off sync music and then synced a couple of times inside iTunes, after which iTunes confirmed there was no music on the phone, which I rechecked through managed storage on the phone. Call me paranoid, but I wanted to make sure I got this right. So he used these steps to totally wipe out the music on his phone. Finally, at this point, I turned on sync music in iTunes and selected which playlists, etc. I wanted to sync to my phone, and then clicked sync. Some hours later, all the music had copied across, which I confirmed by playing tracks from the songs of music with shuffle selected and skipping to the next track several times. It was fixed for a time being, and still is. He says, my analysis of what had happened, because I had done a restore from an iCloud backup and then synced more music on from iTunes, because my new phone is a larger capacity, somehow the phone and iTunes had gotten confused and or out of sync. By this approach, I was able to resynchronize iTunes' belief with what was on the phone against what is truly on the phone. And that I've seen happen, where iTunes thinks that a specific song is on the phone, but it doesn't exist on the phone. And because iTunes thinks it's there, it doesn't push it to the phone when you do your manual sync. So wiping everything out and then turning, I think a big part of it was turning off music sync in iTunes and then turning it back on. In fact, that may have been the only thing you needed to do, but that's a good tip. So thanks for sharing that path with us, Simon. Good stuff. Anything to add there, John? Have you had any experience with iTunes getting itself out of sync?
No.
Okay. Let's see. So while we're working on syncing issues, Jeff wrote in and he said, here's the problem that I had over the past few days. I've noticed that my Safari bookmarks were not updating on my iPad mini. I had my Safari bookmarks sync via iCloud in addition to my mail, calendars, and contacts. I'd make changes to my Safari bookmarks on my iMac, but would not see those changes reflected on my iPad. Then I made a change to bookmarks on the iPad and didn't see that reflected on the Mac or the iPhone. I thought I'd just go into Settings, iCloud, and turn it off and back on, and then sync the Safari bookmarks. No changes. I then checked my contacts and calendar and noticed there was no info in either of them. Now I was in freakout mode, so I checked my calendar and contacts on my Mac, iPhone, and on iCloud.com just to make sure I didn't lose anything, and I did not. After some quick Googling, I found the answer to this problem. What one must do is go into Settings, iCloud, and then delete the iCloud account on the device that has the issue. You then re-add the iCloud account and turn on each item that you want After turning on each item, the data started to populate again on my iPad mini. Catastrophe diverted. So similar to the USB or Wi-Fi sync with iTunes, sometimes you just need to wipe it and start from scratch. And that seemed to work well for Jeff. So syncing tips galore right there. Any thoughts on that one, John, before we move on to our final tip of the day?
Well, I want to say hi to the pugs.
Of course, Jeff has a couple of pugs. That's right. So Rob has an interesting one. He said, yesterday evening, I was listening to Mac Geek Gab as I drove to collect my kids from band practice. I have my iPhone 5 in a holder high up on the dash, and I like to have the screen unlocked on the podcast app so that I have all the playback controls available. Since I don't have an iPhone 5S or 6, hence no Touch ID, I can't use the one-touch unlock that Touch ID gives. Okay. He says, I was getting bothered by the glare from the mostly white screen because the Mac Geek Gab's album art is predominantly white and bright. I then remembered the accessibility settings. By default, if you've turned on accessibility, a triple click of the home button inverts the screen colors. The contrast for driving at night was dramatic. And he took a couple of pictures to show us. So he says, and it totally is. It looks great. So he says, if you're driving at night with your iPhone screen on and the image is very bright, maybe try the invert colors option inside settings accessibility to do that. Just remember, it's triple click on the home button to turn it on and off, because that can be, if your phone gets into that mode, it can be really kind of jarring and you might freak out. So don't freak out. It's all good. You just need to triple click it again. It comes right back. But that is kind of a fun trick to play on people if you're into that sort of thing. Turn on accessibility and do that. I would never do that.
I've noticed some apps actually will figure that out.
Really? Oh, so an app can read the bit from that and know?
Or the time and change the... Like Waze, I've noticed. Waze normally has a white background, but if it's night, it has a black background, so it doesn't blast you.
Does it do it when it's at night, or does it use the ambient light sensor to decide when it should do that?
That's a great question. I don't know.
Because it could do either, right? You know, it could do either. Like my car does that when it senses that the headlights need to come on. It turns the headlights on and then changes the display to go into night mode. Yeah, which is good. You know, I mean, that's how that kind of stuff should be done. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is the email address to which you can send in your tips or questions or cool stuff found. I think the cool stuff found queue is piling up, so we've got one of those coming up here. So keep sending those in.
Yeah. Me, Dave, I prefer to send emails to feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
Now, that's just because that's how you are, but really, feedback@MacGeekGab.com is the right address. Come visit us on Google+. MacGeekGab.com/Google+. We'll get you there. It's an awesome community. And, you know, even when I'm swamped and don't get in there to visit, you folks all answer each other's questions. It's fantastic. I really, really love the way that our community has come together there. So check it out. MacGeekGab.com/Google+. And we look forward to seeing you there. How about the phone number, John? 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335.
That's what you say. We'd like to thank Michael Johnston. He did not convert Mac Geek Gab 520 to AAC. He ran out of time with some of his classes that he's getting back in the swing of there. But he'll be back, and I think, hopefully, this one, 521, will have been converted to AAC for you. And we certainly appreciate all the chapters that he adds and all that good stuff. Michael is the host of the iOS Show podcast and also of the publisher of GetAppler.com. So check that out. CacheFly.com, CacheFly.com is the place that provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you, and they do a fantastic job with it. The podcast marketplace this month includes Barebones Software at Barebones.com, Smile at SmileSoftware.com, Gazelle.com, Squarespace.com/MGG, as we mentioned in the show, Lynda.com/MGG, LYNDA, and of course, the folks at Drobo with the coupon code MGG50 for $50 off on a Drobo third gen. All through Backbeat Media. Thoughts, John? Last little things. Do you have any advice for me as I'm driving down to meet you tomorrow before we head into New York?
Drive like a maniac.
Okay. Okay. Check. I'll write that down. Yes. Yes. Okay. But,
you know, send me your route with a glimpse.
Oh, glimpse? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Yep. Okay. Yeah, I'll do that.
Cool.
Okay.
Oh, and well, the final piece, because things come in threes, is don't get caught.